Welcome, folks. This is Mark Steiner once again. We're about to have a conversation with Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, who is an atmospheric scientist, studies climate change. She's an associate professor in the Department of Political Science and director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University and part of the Department of Interior's South Central Climate Science Center, and an expert reviewer with the Nobel Prize-winning Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And having said all that, she's also an evangelical Christian, so we'll see how that all fits together. Catherine Hayhoe, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark.
So, I mean, all these introductions as a climate scientist, which you are, but one of the keys to your work is the fact that your husband is an evangelical minister, that you wrote a book together, and that you are part of this thing called the Evangelical Climate Initiative. So that sounds to many people like a contradiction. For many, not all, but for many evangelicals in America, and also for other religions as well, that kind of accept sometimes the Bible as the literal word of God, have a difficult time, have problems with the issue of accepting evolution, or that the Earth is billions of years old, and isn't that part of what makes it hard for some people of that deep faith to accept or address climate change?
Well, here's the issue with climate change. We only need to think that the world is at least 300 years old in order to agree that something is different, that people are starting to change the climate. That's the beauty of this. So we have all the time in the world to talk over our differences on creation versus evolution, on a young Earth versus an old Earth, and things like that. But with climate change, it's an issue that's becoming increasingly urgent. We need to figure out solutions soon. And the good thing is we only have to agree that the world is about 300 years old or so to acknowledge the reality of this problem. And I think we can all agree on that one.
So I'm curious how you approach that, though. I mean, how do you approach those conversations and with others, even within your church, and how you approach it with yourself?
Well, one of the main problems with talking about climate change is that it comes with so much baggage. It comes with the baggage you just mentioned, the ancient divides and conflicts between science and religion and faith. It comes with other baggage like Al Gore and liberal perspectives and nasty taxes, government regulations tied around its neck. So what I try to do as a scientist is I try to separate the issue from the baggage so we can just take a clear, unbiased look at the reality of this issue and what it means for us personally, why we might want to care about it, because it matters to us, not because of the polar bears, and then what we can do about it in a sensible way without hopefully invoking too much of that baggage.
So, in exploring that, I mean, well, what do you see as two things? A lot of things, actually. Let me start with one.
Sure.
So what do you see as the importance of things like the Evangelical Climate Initiative? What's happening within that? And so it's almost like, in some senses, it's a special ministry. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, so what is that? And then describe it, and how do you approach your work through it?
Organizations like Evangelical Environmental Network and even other organizations that we're more familiar with, like World Vision and even Christianity Today, these organizations are really essential because they are out there showing us how key issues, including climate change, but many other issues too, are really relevant to our faith. So, for example, the issue of climate change, for a long time it's been perceived as one of loving the planet, and in some cases even loving the planet more than people. And so what I love about the Evangelical Initiative is they are very clearly painting this as an issue about loving people, caring for the poor, caring for the hungry. How are we going to care for people? It's like pouring money into a bucket with a hole in the bottom, and climate change is that hole. It's increasing the risks of droughts and floods and hunger and things like that around the world. We cannot help people the way we want to if we don't account for what's causing a lot of the problems today.
So talk about the problems today, then, from your perspective. I mean, we've just experienced What may be one of the single biggest disasters to hit the United States of America when Sandy hit New Jersey and New York and the devastation that it happened there, the kind of heat we experienced last summer in Texas and Chicago. So talk a bit about how that fits in and into what you talk about in today's world.
Great question. We, as humans, we always want everything kind of black and white. So a lot of people are always asking, well, you know, was this climate change or was that all climate change? And the answer really is what we're doing is we're changing the background conditions of our planet. So whenever a normal natural storm like Sandy comes along, it's occurring over higher sea level, warmer ocean temperatures, different weather patterns than it would have 100 years ago. And so we're seeing different impacts, and in many cases, we're seeing bigger impacts from what used to be entirely natural events, but are now a little bit like natural events on steroids, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Here in the U.S., we're seeing increased frequency of extreme heat. It really hurts us in our pockets with our energy bills in the summer. We're seeing, in some cases, increased risk of drought, and in other cases, like the Northeast, we're seeing increased risk of heavy rainfall and flooding. All of these things cost us money. They affect our houses, our infrastructure, our roads, and like I said, they affect our wallets too.
So given that, a couple of things is kind of really popped in my head as you were describing that. One is there's been a lot of, I've been reading lately about the synergy between the ideas that many scientists are writing about that the Earth may be going through one of its geologically determined climate changes, naturally, and that it is also exacerbated by in this kind of industrial pollution in the air that has caused, that is intensifying the climate change. Do you ever write about that and talk about that with folks, about how those two parts work together?
Absolutely. That's one of the most important things that I, as a climate scientist, can talk about with people. So on Saturday night, when I'm going to be speaking up there in Baltimore, I'm going to be talking exactly about that, about how our climate is always changing because of natural cycles. We know about natural cycles, and they are always going to be there. What is so unusual right now, though, is that according to natural cycles, we should be getting cooler right now. But we are getting warmer. So all of the natural cycles say that either we should be staying the same or getting cooler, but we're getting warmer faster and faster. And when I say we're getting warmer, I'm not talking about, you know, thermometers and satellites, about looking in our own backyards and seeing when our trees are flowering in spring, or what type of bird or insects we see, and if there are insects that used to be further south that are moving north. I'm talking about things like kudzu, that invasive vine that used to be known for taking over the southeast. Kudzu's all the way up in Canada now because the winters are so much warmer. So we're seeing these changes that are not what natural cycles would be giving us right now. We should be getting cooler. So then we have to say, well, why are we getting warmer? And when we look at natural cycles and the sun and volcanoes and all of those things, they don't give us the answer. The only thing that would account for us getting warmer is the fact that when we burn coal or gas or oil, we produce carbon dioxide, which is this heat-trapping gas. And it traps heat just like a blanket does on a cold night. A blanket traps our body heat and keeps us warm. So our atmosphere, our planet, has this perfectly designed blanket that already keeps us about 60 degrees warmer than we would be otherwise. It's a natural blanket, nothing to do with people. What we're doing is we're adding a little bit of extra blanket on top of that. So it's kind of like my grandma used to do when I stayed overnight at her house when I was little. She'd sneak in after I went to sleep and put an extra blanket on me, and I'd wake up sweating because I didn't need it. So that's what we are doing to the planet. We're taking a beautiful, perfect, natural thing, and we're adding just a little bit to it, and that's a little bit too much.
So this is, you know, this is something that gets deeply involved in politics. There's one quote I read in one of the pages that about you that I think the man who got you to come to Texas Tech to be director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University, I think it's his quote. He said, the United States and Canada are the only nations in the world that I've studied out of the 47 developing advanced nations for which I have an idea where that explains someone's position on climate change. More than anything else is their ideology and politics. So ideology and politics do in many ways drive our views about climate change, not necessarily just our religion, though that can be a factor. So you have to address that as well. So you're in the department of political science, and you're also in the science itself. So talk about that, because a moment ago you joked that Al Gore was baggage.
Climate change is unfortunately a very political science, and I say unfortunately because thermometers are not Democrat or Republican. Records of when trees are blooming in the spring or how sea level is rising, that's not blue or red. These are facts. This is information. And so what has happened, though, is that the science has become politicized because we object to the solutions. Now, the solutions should be political because the solutions involve government regulations, market mechanisms, subsidies, taxes, rules. They all involve policy and politics. Solution. But the science is not political. And so what I believe we need to do is we need to take our heads out of the sand and open our eyes, look the problem in the face and say, you know what? Based on my values, my beliefs, my faith, and my politics, here is a viable solution that I think would leave the world a better place, even if it turns out that climate change wasn't as big a problem as we thought it was. So what do I mean by that? Well, if we can in a sensible, sustainable way, transition away from these dirty, outdated fossil fuels we've been using for 300, 400 years, if we can transition sensibly to renewable energy, we'd be investing in our local economy, we'd be cleaning up our air pollution, which in and of itself is responsible for asthma and public health costs all over the country, we'd be increasing our national security because we wouldn't have to depend on other countries, many of whom are unfriendly for our oil, and we'd be giving our children a better future. So I think there's many reasons to adopt sensible solutions that don't threaten the things that we hold near and dear while still being able to look the science in the face.
So you live in Texas.
Yes, I do.
And Texas is a place where oil is still king in many ways. And we just saw a report come out in the Wall Street Journal saying the United States now will be producing more oil and also oil from oil shale and gas from shale than any other country in the world. We'll be the leading country on the planet. So that's part of what that's part of the future. So part of it is political. See what I'm saying? I mean, so the question is how you address that. And I saw one of the slides that you did that you talked about and very good slides and very entertaining and substantive as well, but that one of the things you said when you flashed a picture of Billy Graham, you flashed a picture of Al Gore, and something was about it, and so who's your favorite? And you laughed and said, "Saying, oh, it has to be Billy Graham." But the reality is that Al Gore politically speaks about global warming is something we have to address, whether he can be a problem or not. Where the Reverend Billy Graham is just the opposite, and was with the oil companies, others saying that there's a different way. So I mean, so the question is how you, given where you are, given the realities of all that, how do you tackle that?
Well, I live here in West Texas, where there are oil rigs all over the landscape, including in some people's backyards.
Right, right.
Down.
Right.
But here's an interesting thing: when you drive south of Lubbock, every time I drive south of Lubbock, there are a couple more hundred new wind turbines that have been put up. And these wind turbines are going up on the land of farmers and ranchers who couldn't care less about climate change. If anything, they think it's a natural cycle, even if it's, you know, if it's even real. Why are they putting up these wind turbines? So I got one of these farmers and I said, hey, I said, you know, I noticed that your neighbor has wind turbines, but you don't. Is there a reason? And he said, yeah, it's because the neighbor got on the list before I did. So I said, well, why don't you just put oil rigs on instead? You know, do you have the mineral rights? And he said, oh, yes, but the wind turbines are better because they pay the same amount of money but we never see them again once they've installed them, whereas the oil guys are always on and off our property getting the oil out. So he said anybody with half a brain would rather have the wind energy because it's better and it gives the same amount of money. So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. There's things that we can do that are sensible things, even if we don't think climate change is a problem. And I think we should be doing a lot of those things.
So I'm curious where you think that the importance of the role that you play and others like you. Because, I mean, I think that this idea of people of faith, evangelicals and others getting into this, into the discussion about climate change where we go is really important. But where do you think that takes us? When you look at this last election, and I'm not just pointing in pure political Democrat, Republican things, because I think life is more complex than that. And I think even the votes for either Romney or Obama, those votes were more complex than just the two men. They had to do with people's feelings and visions and about America and the future. So I wonder, given that the vast majority of people who are evangelicals, and I would say the vast majority of people that I know who are Orthodox Jews even, and others, would be on the side of saying climate change is God's will. So I'm curious how you, as a scientist and as a woman who's also an activist, how you address that. I mean, what you say in these discussions, what you say from the heart and the faith to challenge that, because you do have to challenge it if you believe what you believe and they believe what they believe.
Yeah. No, you are absolutely right. I think that the most important message that that I wish people knew is that agreeing with the science, agreeing with what God's creation is telling us about climate change, in no way contradicts our faith. In fact, it's completely 100% compatible with our faith. We don't believe that God created a race of robots. We believe that people have free will. There are verses throughout the Bible talking about how we have the freedom to make decisions and how we should make good choices because there's consequences for bad choices. We look around ourselves today and we see that we live in a world where people make choices all the time. Some of them are good, some of them are not so good, and we bear those consequences. So with the issue of climate change, what happened? God gave us the ability, the intelligence, and the freedom to figure out that we can get enormous amounts of energy from coal and gas and oil. But the consequence to that is it produces this heat-trapping gases that build up in the atmosphere and essentially wrap an extra blanket around our planet. These are the consequences of the choices we've made, and it's entirely compatible with what the Bible tells us about reaping the consequences of what we have sowed.
And how are you perceived, do you think, when you speak? I mean, start with your own church. What's the name of the church again that your husband is the minister of?
It's called Ecclesia. It's a Bible church.
Right, Ecclesia. How is it perceived among folks in your own backyard?
Well, the problem is that many of the people who we trust, many of our leaders, many of the people we listen to in the media, many of the people that we as a Christian community trust are telling us that it's not a real problem. But you know what? The honest truth is we're being fed snake oil. We are being fed a bunch of lies. The stuff that I hear about how it's not happening, or if it is, it can't be people, or if it is people, then it's God's will, that's ridiculous. The reality of it is that the science is very clear. There is a consensus in the scientific community that's really unprecedented on the reality of this issue, the fact that humans are the main, but not the only, the main cause. And also, not just that, but my own research talks about what it means for us. So if we live in Baltimore, what does climate change mean to our heating bill in the winter? It means a good thing for that. What does it mean to our air conditioning bills in the summer? What does it mean to the types of trees and plants and birds and animals we're going to have in our backyard? What does it mean to sea level rise and to the impacts of sea level rise on any storms that might come along? What does it mean to our offshore fishing industry or to our agricultural industry or to our water supply? These are the things I study because this is where it hurts. I think that, and I'm getting back to our current political climate, which you brought up, I think that there has been a misperception on both sides of the aisle these past 4 years that climate change is a distant problem that does not matter to us here in the United States. And my research and that of my colleagues shows clearly that that is not the case. Climate change is already exacting hidden costs from each one of us, and those costs are only going to climb over time unless we start factoring them into the decisions that we're making right now.
So, and before we end, Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, talk a bit about what this launch of Interfaith Power and Light is that will be coming up this weekend.
Sure. Interfaith Power and Light is an organization that puts local chapters in different cities and states around the country to help people of faith think about how to live more sustainably. How can we save energy? How can we make our churches and our buildings more efficient? How can we live in a way that really respects God's creation and expresses our appreciation for what he's given us? So Interfaith Power and Light is a great organization. It's very ecumenical and welcome to all, but it encourages people to use their faith to explore what that means for climate change and for other issues related to the planet.
Well, I'm looking forward to having you come to Baltimore.
I am, too. I'll be talking about all this stuff in a lot more detail on Saturday night, and everybody's welcome to come.
And Dr. Catherine Hayhoe will be here this Saturday night, 6 to 9 p.m., in a celebration of religious environmental action here in Baltimore, the launch of the Interfaith Power and Light's work in Central Maryland. It'll be at Notre Dame of Maryland University over on Charles Street. And you should not miss a chance to have a dialogue with Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. Catherine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mark. My pleasure.